Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we're going to have John Messler, an anti-war activist who spent his own money and his own energy to go to Syria to see what's really going on in Syria. And he wrote an exclusive report for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox called An American in Syria. So stay tuned and I'll let John Messler tell you about his trip and about himself. John Messler, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you very much, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, thank you. And you've written a couple articles for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, but this is the first time I think you've been on the show. So tell my listeners a little bit about yourself.
All righty. Yeah, this is the first time I'm on the show. I'm a 62-year-old retired public employee / songwriter. I had worked for a local government since about 1974 for about 38 years. I was a laborer in a public works department. Then I moved on to eventually became the superintendent. And at the same time, I was a songwriter. I had gotten two songs into a movie, a Dennis Hopper movie in 1994 that I co-wrote with Jim Lauderdale, called Chasers with Tom Berenger and Dennis Hopper. And like most Americans, I paid a little attention to what was going on, and I had really little reason to doubt most of what I was hearing on mainstream media until I retired. And then I had a chance to I made some Facebook friends, one of them being Rick Stagenberg. And Rick was in New Jersey one day right after I retired. And he had just asked out on Facebook if anybody's available to give him a ride. He was in New Jersey to go to New York on an activist. I forgot exactly what the purpose was, but he needed a ride to Newark Airport. So I picked him up, and we had lunch together. And I asked him if he could suggest any books for me to read to get more information from. And this is back in early 2012. About the same time that you first published my first article on Syria. And one of the books he told me about was S. Brian Wilson's book, Blood on the Tracks.
Right.
And that really woke me up. I had heard about some of the situations, some of the lies back in the 1960s in Vietnam and Indonesia before that and so on and so forth. But S. Brian Wilson's book was a real eye-opener. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't really surprised, but it got me started. And the more I learned, the more, unfortunately, or for better or for worse, I wanted to find out more and more about what was going on. So after that, I just kept on reading books, and I'm still reading books and speaking to people from foreign countries, mostly Iraq and Syria. And recently, as you know, I was lucky enough to go to the Middle East for the first time and got into Syria as part of a delegation.
Well, tell my listeners, how were you able to join that delegation, and what prompted you to do that?
Basically, it was pretty much by 2000, after 6 months of reading books, I knew that we weren't getting the truth, and I had a lot of Facebook friends. And Rick Stagenberg was a Facebook friend who eventually became a real friend, as did many of the Syrian and Iraqi friends that started off as Facebook friends. So I can't mention the names because it's still very, very dangerous in Syria. And it's not, as we've been told, a civil war. It never was a civil war. But one of my Facebook friends up in the Latakia area suggested that I go in April, try to go in April. Now, she thought I could get a visa easily enough. I went to New York in March of 2015, got my visa to Lebanon. And when I arrived in Beirut, I went it's a funny little story. My first experience, as soon as I got off the plane and to get a taxi, the fella picked me up and I told him what hotel I was going to. He spoke English fairly well. And halfway there, he pulled over. And because of the indoctrination that all the Arabs and the Muslims hate Americans and they hate Westerners, as soon as he pulled over to the side of the road, I got a little nervous. Uh-huh. I mean, I went there knowing that it wasn't what we were told. But still, I mean, they've been doing this. The media's been doing this to us for 60 years. So you don't just turn it off in a heartbeat.
Right.
But when he pulled over, he took out a bottle of whiskey that he had between the seats. He brought out two little glasses, and he welcomed me to the Middle East. And he took me right to my hotel after that. And beforehand, this person in Latakia also told me that I should go to the embassy my first day there, to the Syrian embassy in Beirut. But she also told me about a delegation that happened to be coinciding with my trip, which was going to start on the 21st of April. I had gone to Beirut on April the 7th. Dr. Declan Hayes, he's Irish, but he's located in London, England, was heading this delegation, a peace delegation, reconciliation slash peace delegation, if you will. And she suggested that I write him and send him the article that you first published back in, I think it was 2013. Apparently, he liked what he read. We were of like minds. I didn't have much luck at the Syrian embassy. They told me it would take at least 14 days, and they couldn't even guarantee at that time that I'd get one. But within my first two or three days of being in Beirut, and before I got this email from Dr. Declan Hayes, I kind of thought that I'll be in Beirut. I'll just interview as many Syrian refugees as I possibly can. And I did interview quite a few and met quite a few Facebook friends, and they introduced me to others. But after my third or fourth day of being in Beirut, I got the email from Dr. Declan Hayes and also from Dr. Ahmad Salah in Damascus. He's a doctor and a professor of economics at Damascus University, and they said that I had been accepted and that I'd be joining two others in Beirut, both British, Reverend Andrew Ashdown and Dr. Simon Keyes. And on the 21st of April, we headed out to Damascus, and we stayed there for 5 days.
Right. So.
Yeah, it was. I was very fortunate.
So, you said earlier that this situation in Syria is not a civil war. It never has been a civil war. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you can go back as far as 1980. When Brzezinski, for the National Security Advisor, it was classified until 2008, but he wrote pieces and he was involved in meetings as far back as 1980 under the Reagan administration that we wanted control of Syria. We wanted to take over the state, the country of Syria. At that time, there was some fighting between the Muslim Brotherhood, extremist Sunnis, and Hamas. And again, in the 1990s, we heard about the plan for the new American century, which is pretty well known now by General Weston. What had started in March of 2011 were legitimate protests. There had been a five-year drought. The economy was going downhill. There weren't as many subsidies as there had been prior to when Bashar al-Assad took over in 2000. So there were some protesters, but that was quickly hijacked. In my article, I write about Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey being the three bad players in that area. They had been, and the U.S. had been supplying anti-Assad people, whether they be Wahhabi extremists from Saudi Arabia or some Syrian militants or paid mercenaries or thugs, poverty-ridden ones, uneducated ones. They were paid a lot of money to hide weapons and to infiltrate the protests when they started in March of 2011. Shots were fired. Shots were returned by the police. I'm sure some innocent people did get killed. It was a very foggy situation at first, but it quickly became known when Qatar supplied the extremists and the people that were going against al-Assad. They wanted to build a pipeline. When I say they, I'm talking about Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Qatar is the world's second largest exporter of liquid natural gas, and they wanted a pipeline to go through Qatar and Saudi Arabia into Turkey. The only way geographically to do that, of course, is to go through Syria. President Assad was dead set against building that pipeline, and that was publicly known by 2006. That's one of the reasons we started supplying people against Assad in Syria with, I think we started off giving them $3 million, and like I said in the article, Qatar upped it to $3 billion to topple Assad in 2011. It was quickly discovered what was really going on, because at the time, a fellow by the name of Ali Haider, who was the president of the SSNP, the Syrian Socialist National Party, was one of the protesters out there. He and some of those people, the other parties that were against the Ba'ath Party, wanted a more open society. They wanted some of the subsidies back. They just wanted changes, reforms. They didn't necessarily want to topple President Assad. Once they saw what was going on, they quickly said, no, we're no longer going to be part of these protests. They are now, they quickly changed direction, started fighting with the Syrian people, with President Assad, against these foreign entities, these paid mercenaries, and it just grew and grew. The money continued to flow in from Qatar, the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, which is a safe haven. It has been a safe haven for a lot of these extremists, these militants. I like to just call them militants. It's hard to define the difference between a terrorist, which are mostly politically motivated, and there are some Islamist extremists. But as I found out over there, they're not accepted by most Muslims, and they do speak out against them. But you don't hear too much of that, because that's not in our media's agenda to let us know that there's 99.9% of the Muslims are not extremists, and they actually do speak out against these people. So what did start off as protests in 2011 quickly was recognized by the Syrian people, and they started to have to fight against these paid mercenaries.
So what was that trip like? I've been to the Middle East. I've been to Jordan, and I met with Iraqi parliamentarians there. As a matter of fact, we tried to get one of the parliamentarians from Iraq tried to get us a visa to go meet with al-Assad in 2007, I think, and it just didn't work out. It just couldn't go that fast. But anyway, what was your trip like? Was it, you'd never been to the Middle East before. How was that for you?
It was scary going against the flow. I mean, I'm 62 years old, and I don't want to give in. I want to continue to expand my life, and I wanted to prove that the information I was hearing from trusted sources were real.
Uh-huh.
I was scared. I was a little nervous going there. But as soon as I landed, as soon as I got into that taxi, and from day one, I was treated with respect, genuine respect and warmth from a vast majority of the people. I really had to think hard to think of any people. There were a few beggars, not any different than you might find in any of the boroughs of New York. I mean,
San Francisco.
More and more cities in the United States as the middle class continues to dwindle, right? But everybody was I was charmed. I was overwhelmed with the genuine open arms and friendliness. Both in Beirut, I met a few Syrian refugees that were Facebook friends, and they took me to Juni, which is just north of Beirut. We traveled around. We interviewed as many people as we could. Not everybody supports Bashar al-Assad, but a vast majority of the people do. And when I got into Damascus, the warmth continued. As soon as we pulled in, we had our room wasn't ready yet, so we went to Old Damascus. We hopped in a taxi. Nobody ever told us that anything was off limits. We didn't have any minders, what they call them in North Korea, people going around with you, telling you what you can talk about, what you can't talk about, who you can talk to, who you can't talk to. We were free to speak to anybody from day one. So as soon as we went to Old Damascus, I contacted some of my Facebook friends who knew I was coming. And my very next day, I started off by having breakfast with Suzanne, who invited me to have dinner with her and her family on Friday night. I got there on a Thursday, or I think I actually got there on a Wednesday. So I spoke to her on Wednesday. I met her for breakfast on Thursday morning. And I met her entire family on Friday night. A Facebook friend from Aleppo, which is a town really under siege,
right?
Since the very beginning, it's on the northern border of Syria, right? Just south, almost walking distance from Turkey. Aleppo was Syria's largest city as far as population. It had a population of 5 million. Syria's population was roughly 22 million people before this started, before people started getting displaced. And we hear so many, before I get back to my story with Shahi, just a figure, you hear about so many, before this current refugee problem, because Lebanon and Turkey just closed their doors to refugees 2 months ago, and before we're hearing all the news about now that they're infiltrating and trying to get into Germany and different cities in Europe, and I think the United States finally said, we'll even take 10,000.
Right.
What a kind gesture that
After
was.
After they caused the humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, we caused the whole thing. And we're going to be kind enough to take in 10,000. I think Germany's taking 800,000.
Whoa.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken. Or, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 800,000. But anyway, we heard about there being 8 to 12 million displacements. Well, 8 of the 12 million that were displaced or were refugees before this prior situation were simply people that lived in Aleppo, which had 5 million, people that lived in Raqqa, people that lived in Idlib, cities that were to the east. It's a very vast country, and the SAA, or the Syrian Arab Army, is based in Damascus. They have every man has to serve 4 years after he graduates college. And it's similar to Switzerland. Every male has to serve for, I think, 30 or 40 years, less and less time every year as you near the age 40 or 45. But every man has to serve in the Syrian Arab Army, unless it's a single male. If there's more than one man in the family, then they all have to serve. They're based in Damascus. They're able to now keep Damascus homes, city of Malula, Sadnaya, cities in the west or the Levant, what they call the Levant, they're able to protect. But these 8 million people that were out there in the wide open, like in Raqqa, like in a lot of these cities closer to the Turkish border, they had to leave because of the paid mercenaries and the terrorists that the SAA, the Syrian Arab Army, simply didn't have enough people to protect everybody. So when you hear about 8 million being displaced, well, they were displaced not because they were leaving because of Bashar al-Assad, not because they were afraid and they were being tortured in prison by Bashar al-Assad, but they had to leave because they were in cities that were just too far away from Damascus for the SAA to protect. So that was the question my wife had asked me before she heard General Clark's speech. That kind of turned her, got her attention. Mm-hmm. That's why I still mention that speech. It's old hat to you and I, but I think it's important that people do see that. I have to remember that not everybody has been passionate about this as you and I have been. So that's why at that time, and to this day, the majority of the people do leave. Now, Shahay is my friend from Aleppo, a Facebook friend. He traveled all the way to Damascus, and I met him for lunch on Friday, the same day that I was having dinner with Suzanne and her entire family in Damascus. He traveled all the way from Aleppo. It took him 8 hours. It's normally just a two-hour ride, but because of the dangers and the checkpoints, it took him a long time. So he and his daughter Annie and his son-in-law Kevo, K-E-V-O, who's in the Syrian Arab Army, met me at my motel, the Dama Rose, and they took me to Old Damascus to their apartment, and we had kebabs, and we spoke, and we had other people come over, and we all, they were kind, and they were very, they wanted to answer questions, they wanted to know how Americans felt, and they wanted me to get their message to Americans. Now, on the prior day, in the weeks that followed, in the weeks just prior to Shahi coming to visit me, the SAA, the Syrian Arab Army, did have the terrorists, the bad guys, surrounded in the center of Aleppo. It's called the Citadel. They were starving them out, and this is where you hear the half-lies, the half-truths, I guess is a better way of phrasing it, from people that appear credible, like Charlie Rose and Scott Pelley on CBS. So they're not totally lying when they make a report that Bashar al-Assad is starving or killing some of his own people. Well, in that group of all terrorists that were in the center of Aleppo just before Shahi came down to meet me in Damascus, were there some Syrians? Yeah, there probably were some Syrians, but they're mostly Chechens. They're mostly from Tunisia. They're Saudi Arabian Wahhabis. They're from a lot of the countries. Libya, now that we screwed up Libya, has been a safe haven for terrorists. And
right. Well,
that's pretty much what's been going on. So Shahay brought a video that he took the morning that he left, because apparently Turkey was able to break through the lines and resupply the terrorists in the center of town, and the missiles were being fired from the center of town. And Shahi took a video of what that was like and what it sounded like, and he showed that to me when we got together in Damascus on Friday. And it's just amazing. I give him a lot of credit for holding ground.
Well, John, before we run out of time, I'd like you to talk about the controversy that your article has caused. My blog, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, we posted your article there, and it got quite a few comments. And I just want you to respond to the prevailing comment that you know, you've got a lot of comments of support, but you and the people who supported you are saying that you belong to al-Assad's, electronic defense force or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then the people are quoting or, you know, using sources like Amnesty International, which you and I rightly point out were the ones that lied about Iraqi troops taking babies out of incubators in Kuwait and just throwing them on the ground to use the incubators for something. And it was proven that Amnesty International collaborated with the elite in Kuwait and the U.S. government to promote that, this lie, yet these people are listening to them. I don't understand how people can believe anything our government or the supporting NGOs say really about anything. But can you respond? Are you a paid blogger for Al-Assad and Syria?
No, I'm not. Neither is Mother Agnes. She's been called the same thing. And by the way, Mother Agnes was one of the protesters when this thing initiated back in 2011. What you're speaking about is the Naira al-Sabah. She was the daughter of the ambassador of Kuwait. She was paid, or Hill and Knowlton was a public relations firm that was paid $1 million a month to have her lie. And Congressman Lantos brought her forward, Amnesty International. Of course, that was one of the things that, like David Swanson always says, you dehumanize the enemy. And it works. It's starting not to, I hope. I hope there's more people like me out there that are paying more attention. And there's a lot of sources now to find the truth. But yeah, these two, if you notice, first of all, you can Google Naira al-Sabah, anybody that's listening, Nayirah, and that's about the incubators, and
right. The
truth finally does come out, but of course you'll never see that in the headlines or even in the newspapers or any part of mainstream media. Most of the comments that your blog got were from Syrians, and you'll notice that the two that that were calling me the electronic whatever right. It was, I question the, and they both almost sounded, they both used the same words. I'm not even sure they were two different people.
Right.
But no, I'm not paid by any group. I went there. Some of the groups that they pointed out, like you suggested, you stated, Amnesty International supported this woman back in 1991 about the lies. She mentioned one of the people who commented mentioned the Syrian Medical Society, but that's an opposition group, and many doctors have been proven to be part of ISIS and Al-Qaeda supporters from the Syrian Medical Society. I think she mentioned the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, but they've always been part of al-Nusra. She went on, she said that the SAA, or the Syrian Arab Army, what I'll refer to as the good guys, Bashar al-Assad's soldiers, overtook the city of Idlib. That's not the truth. Idlib was taken over by al-Nusra or FSA and other militant groups, not by Bashar al-Assad's people, not by his military. They went in and rescued as many people as they could. And again, I was watching 60 Minutes one night, and I was infuriated when Scott Pelley said that Bashar al-Assad was killing his own people in Homs, which is the third or fourth largest city. I've got good friends now in Homs, incredible friends, and they're not even pro of some of them are not pro Bashar al-Assad. They don't like a lot of his domestic policies. But they told me that there was one section where they were starving out again. They let these people know ahead of time, there's too many terrorists, we're coming in, get out. So they're given plenty of advance notice, but are there a few left behind? Sure. Are there a few Syrians that are militants and that fight with al-Nusra? Yeah, a small percentage, but there are some. So that's how people like Scott Pelley can say what they say, and I suppose sleep at night somehow.
Well, you mentioned him and Charlie Rose as being so-called credible sources. I really don't think so. I think they're just propagandists for, the U.S. military industrial complex. And so are many of the sources that these people that criticized you, that they quote, and they're not credible sources. Well, John, I really appreciate you going to Syria and being a witness and coming back and reporting what you saw. And for this show and the newsletter, we'll of course link the article and hope that this keeps the dialogue going, because even though it seems like those people who were in opposition to you aren't listening, that they're coming with their own agenda, at least it's creating a discussion that really is missing. The side of the Syrian people, just because we oppose U.S. military intervention doesn't mean that we doesn't mean that we necessarily support the other regime. We support the people and we support peace.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And I thank you, Cindy, very much. It's a pleasure to meet you. It's a pleasure to finally talk to you, and I'm honored to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, John, do you have a way people can contact you? Or?
Yeah. My email is messlerjohn@yahoo.com. There's one S, M-E-S-L-E-R, John, J-O-H-N. MesslerJohn@yahoo.com.
Okay, John, like I said, we'll post that and we'll post the article. And again, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and talk to you soon.
Thank you, Cindy, very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired, and I hope you will go to cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com and read John's report, An American in Syria. So, as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. It's been a rough couple weeks, so I haven't presented a new show, but it seems like Dee Dee is holding her own, and she's got about 8 more weeks of chemo left, and then we'll see what happens after that. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.